When a man and woman fall in love.
Love. Strange words. Children, love. What is love?
Love is when two people are...
Ah, yes, the holding, the touching. Vol has forbidden this.
Well, there goes paradise.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me. No more. Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me. No more. What is love?
Podcasting, The Final Frontier. These are the ridiculous introductions I am forced to read at gunpoint, or should I say phaser point. Welcome to Ship to Ship, yet another in the long line of tedious Star Trek podcasts. The show is hosted by David Lawler and David B. Anderson. The two Davids will take you on a journey through time and space every 3 or 4 weeks, boldly podcasting where no podcast has gone before. Seriously? This is what you're making me read? Take it away, boys.
Hello, this is David Anderson, and this is Ship to Ship, a Star Trek podcast. With me, as always, is Mr. David Lawler. How are you tonight, sir?
Fuck you!
Fuck you!
Fuck you!
Fuck you!
For being late.
Fuck you!
Now we have to...
I'm a busy man!
Fuck you!
I'm a busy man.
We have to rush through this. You do not deserve to smell my shit.
Fuck you!
Fuck you!
Okay, well, what are we talking about here? We're talking about Vulcans?
Vulcans and Ponfar.
Vulcans and Ponfar. Three episodes, right? The original, which was the source and the inspiration and the origin of this whole thing.
Yeah.
Amok Time from the second season. The actual broadcast premiere episode of the second season.
Which I watched when you were telling me to watch the first episode, and then I watched it. And then you said, no, it's not that episode. So I watched it.
It was supposed to be the Halloween episode. And then after that, two episodes on Voyager, because there were no prominent or any kind of major or even supporting characters that were Vulcan on Next Generation or Deep Space Nine. So we got to go jump forward straight all the way to, 1995-ish to get to Voyager so that we can talk about Tuvok's character. Which...
Yeah, and I would – can I say that they're both almost played for comedy, both of them?
Yeah, kind of. I don't know. Not the third. I don't think the third episode, but the third episode is Body and Soul, and that's from season 7. And that is really kind of more of a B plot, of the episode. The actual episode is about 7 of 9 and the Doctor, more than it is about Tuvok. It's just like a sort of like
yeah,
a,
but the
it's a B plot. It's something that we didn't really do A and B plots on other Star Trek shows. We did it mainly with maybe Deep Space Nine and Voyager, I guess.
I'd say that the Ponfar segment, they very much almost like recycled some stuff. It's like, oh, we have this idea, we have this concept of holodecks and what we can do with that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the concept from the Blood Fever episode. But first, let's talk about Amok Time. This is one of those classic episodes of Star Trek, the original series, right up there with City on the Edge of Forever and The Trouble with Tribbles and Mirror, Mirror and things like that. And this is the episode that it's a world-building episode, which is kind of a rarity for the original show, because the original show was very much fixated on its lead actors. But occasionally you would get something where we talked about the Romulans and we talked about the Klingons.
Yep.
And here we're getting the Vulcans. Spock is not quite himself. He's given to fits of rage. McCoy tries to tell Kirk about this, but Kirk doesn't seem interested until Spock throws a bowl of soup at Christine Chapel.
Oh, Captain. Got a minute?
A minute.
It's Spock. Have you noticed anything strange about him?
No, nothing in particular. What?
Well, it's nothing I can pinpoint without an examination, but he's become increasingly restive. If he were not a Vulcan, I'd almost say nervous. And for another thing, he's avoiding food. I checked, and he hasn't eaten at all in 3 days.
Well, that just sounds like Mr. Spock in one of his contemplated phases.
What is this? Ah! I'm crying. If I want anything from you, I'll ask for it.
who's just trying to be nice, even though, you know.
Yeah, I think now, would you say that this is they had a full idea of what they were going to do with Spock and the Pon Farr and everything? Because, you know, that they would always fudge it later about, like, what it is and what it isn't. And
Well, I don't think they had a clear idea, because that's just not the way things were. That's not how you wrote back then for television. You didn't. You had your story consultant who would try to keep continuity and try to keep and establish a canon. I don't even think canon meant anything back then, because, I mean, it just, hey, you know, it seems like
it was
like,
spaceships. It was in color.
Do you ever watch? Well, did you ever watch The Odd Couple, the old Odd Couple show with Jack Klugman, Tony Randall?
Oh, of course.
There are like 20 episodes in there that all tell different stories as to how Felix and Oscar met, and they completely they don't care that there are no angry
it's
Odd Couple
sort of
fans
like
to say that's
Rocky
not how they met,
where they misremember things or something like that.
The whole world thinks I'm a neurotic madman, and I'm going to kill you for that.
And also the divorces, and when the divorces from their wives occurred, and when they became roommates, when they, you know, all they just totally change everything around just to suit the episode. But Star Trek might have been the first attempt to try to have a kind of biblical canon, so to speak. But I mean, like, I think what this is written by Theodore Sturgeon. Ted Sturgeon is one of the great science fiction writers of our time, to quote Harlan Ellison, who was a close personal friend of Sturgeon, who they shared a small apartment. They typed on the same typewriter. Ellison talked about a cheap pipe that Ted Sturgeon smoked that was great flavored tobacco. And he wrote a very cute intro to a collection of works by Ted Sturgeon, where he talks about how he and Ted got up to lots of shenanigans, mainly chasing girls around and getting drunk. And he says,
"That's always fun."
He says, "Most of what I know about Ted Sturgeon, I cannot tell you." But Ted Sturgeon is one of the great. I have a couple of books of his. He's a great science fiction writer. He also wrote another episode of Star Trek called Shore Leave, which is another popular favorite. Back when I put together the ideas for this podcast, I wanted to do a spotlight on writers to talk about what they wrote. Ted Sturgeon was one of them. Robert Bloch was another. Now McCoy comes up with the central conceit of this, is which is that he's going to die. Spock's going to die because his behavior is crazy. He's having lots of adrenaline pumped into his bloodstream because of his anger and everything.
Jim, you've got to get Spock to Vulcan.
Bones, I will. As soon as this mission is
completed. No, now, right away. If you don't get him to Vulcan within a week, 8 days at the outside, he'll die.
Kirk corners Spock and asks him what the hell's going on. Spock tells him, you know, with a little bit of prodding, that he's going through something called the Pon Farr, which is a Vulcan mating cycle, which occurs every 7 years.
This kind of is something that they do in all three episodes, less so in the third, because they kind of know what's going on.
they do. Because Pon Farr is sort of
truth out of the guy.
It's a focus of Star Trek III, so we're well acquainted with it. The kid is going through incredible growing pains in that, but we'll get to that the next time we.
Yeah, but I'm talking about like the characters. They always like, you know, what is this? And they're always like, it is a private matter. It's always like,
yeah, they never want to talk about. Well, I can understand. I mean, it's sex. You know, I mean, like Vulcans, they don't volunteer anything anyway, so they're gonna be like a clam when it comes to sex. I can understand that.
Even with the doctor.
The doctor has to guess, and I guess he's just that good that he's able to guess. So Spock says, every 7 years, Vulcans get sexual mating drives, and they have to go, I guess, do it or something along those lines.
Hump, death, hump, death, hump, death, hump, death, hump, death, hump, death. Your time is running out.
They have to do it or they die.
Yeah. Even though according to Enterprise, we do find out that Vulcans do have sex for pleasure. I mean, they do have sex without having to go through the Pon Farr. They do it. I mean, I don't know if they do it for. They will tell you right now. No, we don't do it for pleasure.
Has to do with biology.
What?
Biology.
What kind of biology?
Vulcan biology.
You mean the biology of Vulcans? Biology as in reproduction? It's a There's no need to be embarrassed about it, Mr. Spock. It happens to the birds and the bees.
The birds and the bees are not Vulcans, Captain. If they were, if any creature as proudly logical as us were to have their logic ripped from them as this time does to us, how do Vulcans choose their mates? Haven't you wondered?
I guess the rest of us assume that it's done quite logically.
No. It is not. We shield it with ritual and customs shrouded in antiquity. You humans have no conception. It strips our minds from us. It brings a madness which rips away our veneer of civilization. It is the Pon Farr, the time of mating.
Isn't the rule that they either have to like fuck somebody or kill somebody? That's,
well, I mean,
like, that's
Spock's,
the only way it goes away.
Spock says I have to take a wife or something, which means he has to get married. But I guess marriage was shorthand back then in the late 60s for sex, because no one
well,
ever
of course,
talked about
they both go together. Of course,
they well, nobody ever talked about extramarital sex back then. This was during a very restrictive
well,
time.
Honestly, it probably happened less. Everybody's like a slut now.
Well, maybe less publicized. I'm not really sure.
I'm sure it happened, but it was less prevalent than it is now. That sexual revolution messed it up for everybody.
And the pill and everything. That yeah, you certainly don't sound like a liberal tonight. Anyway,
I can get cranky sometimes.
God damn sexual revolution! Chicks walking around with.
Did you just point at me?
Space Force.
With the whipping it out like that.
Laura Petrie and all that shit. Mary Tyler Moore. So, Kirk, after some deliberation with McCoy, they have a really great conversation. Kirk has a, you know, I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, like he's willing to risk everything for Spock, and he does it again in the movie Star Trek III.
I know the Altair situation. We would be one of three starships, very impressive, very diplomatic, but it's simply not that vital.
You can't go off to Vulcan against Starfleet orders. You'll be busted.
And I can't let Spock die, can I, Bones? And he will if we go to Altair. I owe my life a dozen times over. Isn't that worth a career? He's my friend. Bridge navigation.
Bridge navigation.
Mr. Chekhov, lay in a course for Vulcan. Tell engineering I want warp 8 or better. Pusher for all she'll take.
Course already plotted. Laying it in, sir.
I see. Very well. Carry on, Mr. Chekhov. Kirk out.
So he disobeys orders. He's supposed to go to some kind of hoity-toity celebration of something with a bunch of starships and look really good for the Federation. And he says, I can't let Spock die. He disobeys orders, takes the ship to Vulcan. And this is where we get our first glimpse of Vulcan. Actually, with the remastered version, there's a couple of really extravagant wide shots of Vulcan that they've added that resemble the area where at the end of Star Trek III, Search for Spock, where we see.
So they're trying to kind of get more sort of it, because Vulcan on the show usually looked very much like every other planet.
It was just, yeah, it just had a red backdrop and it looked like it was in a studio.
Looked, in the movies, it had more almost, it had like a haze and it was sort of mystical.
Yeah. And what's more, you know, at least you have to give it to the guys who did the reboot of Star Trek in 2009, they incorporated the look of Vulcan that we see from not only Star Trek III, but from Star Trek the Motion Picture, too.
If I'm not mistaken, in the new Star Trek movie, they even it's on Vasquez Rock, if I'm not mistaken. Like, that's in there somewhere?
Yeah, definitely. Well, everybody, you know, every show has shot at Vasquez Rocks. So we are introduced to Spock's intended to bring, played by the lovely Arlene Martel, who has been in everything. She was in Outer Limits episode written by Harlan Ellison. She was in an episode of The Monkees, for crying out loud. She was on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. She was on The Twilight Zone. and she plays to bring.
Spock, it is I.
T'Pring, parted from me and never parted, never and always touching and touched, we meet at the appointed place.
Spock, parted from me and never parted, never and always touching and touched, I await you.
And T'Pring... And the ceremony is officiated by T'Pau, who is a high Vulcan representative dignitary who's officiating the wedding. We do meet T'Pau later on, a young T'Pau, very hot T'Pau, in a three-part episode of Enterprise, where she becomes the de facto head of the Vulcan. She's accused of terrorism early on, and then it's revealed that it was just a bunch of
not to be confused with T'Pol.
T'Pol.
Not to be confused with T'Pau, the band with the hit single "Heart and Soul,"
which are obviously those guys were obviously Star Trek fans. Their name was T'Pau, and they have a song called "Heart and Soul." And T'Pau actually says, "This is the Vulcan heart. This is the Vulcan soul."
What they are about to see comes down from the time of the beginning without change. This is the Vulcan heart. This is the Vulcan soul. This is our way.
Before I get into my major problems, if you will, and yeah, I do have problems. I did want to talk a little bit about the Vulcan greeting. Now, I watched the documentary that Adam Nimoy did for The Love of Spock, and they talked about the origin of the Vulcan greeting and how Leonard Nimoy was a young boy in a Jewish synagogue, and you're supposed to cover your eyes when a rabbi does a particular blessing, which he does by splaying out his fingers and forming that V shape that we all know.
Mm-hmm.
He says that the Vulcans should have a greeting. He's talking to the director, and he's like, what do you have in mind? And he says, well, how about we do this? Now, also, I don't think it's mentioned in the documentary. That greeting would never have been used if Celia Lubsky, who plays T'Pau, was not able to do it. So we'll try it with her. If she can do it, then it'll be in. And that's the only way they got it through, was that she basically sold it by being able to do it. So if she wasn't able to do it, we would have never had a Vulcan greeting.
Interesting. Now, of course,
and a lot of people can't. A lot of people can't. My wife can't do it, but my daughter can.
Well, let me see. I'm going to do it right now. Yeah, I can do it. I can do it on the right hand, left hand, no.
I can do it on both hands. I can do it on both hands.
Well, fancy. You probably trained yourself over the years to get
probably,
it.
Probably. I think I'm Jewish.
You could be.
Anyway, a lot of people can't do it. A lot of people can. So it is, I guess it's tough for some people to be able to do that. T'Pring has engineered a scheme. She does not want to marry Spock. She said she didn't want to be a consort of a legend or something like that. And also, I gotta point out the consort thing, but I'm going to get into that in a second. So she arranges that Spock has to fight and possibly risk his life to obtain this woman who's been promised to him.
That's sort of an allegory for life of, like, sometimes you got to fight over your woman. You got to fight another dude to get the woman, something.
Neither of their hearts are in. I don't think Spock is too keen on getting married. He's just being driven by biological impulses.
I just realized this is kind of like a recurring theme, at least in the first episode of Voyager that I watched. An unwilling Ponfar participant.
Yeah, you're talking about, like, B'Elanna?
I'm talking about now. That's a whole other thing where it's like she's not even of the race, and it's like they're on the ship and they're trapped. But
it's a little weird. Like, yeah,
I'm like, yeah. What if you are betrothed, and you know these are Vulcans. This isn't humans where you can just sort of like you're gonna die unless you do it.
Hump death, hump death, hump death.
Right.
It's like you're stuck with this person.
Yeah, that's what it seems to be, and they do have a very rigid code about that. And T'Pol. In Enterprise is also bound by that custom too, mm-hmm. where she is supposed to marry. And this, I'll get into this in a second, but first, the big plot point is that T'Pring does not pick her lover. She has a lover named Stahn. She picks Kirk to fight in her stead.
T'Pring, you will choose thy champion.
As it was in the dawn of our days, as it is today, as it will be for all tomorrows, I make my choice.
one.
And this is like really kind of fucked up, and probably an infraction of protocol on the highest level. I can't imagine that this woman could get away with this and not be punished in some way for this, because she's implicating, she may be causing a Starfleet officer, two Starfleet officers, to be killed if possible, and she doesn't seem to care, and she doesn't seem to have much of a conscience, which. Signals to me another problem with the whole Vulcan, with a lot of the Vulcan world building that goes on. And I can forgive Theodore Sturgeon because he's inventing this. He did this on his typewriter, and then later on, I mean, over 50 years, you have writers writing off of that, and they're being very faithful and very, very, very loyal to his original work. But my big problem, before we get into the fight and all that, the Vulcans have always called themselves progressive. They have an arrogant attitude when it comes to humans. Look at humans as nothing more than barbarians. Yet what do they have to do to procreate?
Hump death! Hump death!
They have to engage in violent, barbaric conflicts, even in the 23rd, well into the 23rd century, because this is like a residue of the fact that they were so emotionally unstable before, right?
You know what? I just realized something, and then maybe this goes back to me being a conservative Dave tonight. Isn't that kind of the way that the left is a little bit? They get so up their own ass about, you're supposed to do this, you're supposed to do that in this way, or you're not woke. And then they're just as full of shit as everybody else, and they get up to all kinds of shenanigans just like everybody else.
Did you just point at me?
This is David Anderson I'm talking to, right? The one who lives near Seattle.
I mean, like, Republicans, they're gross and they're wrong a lot of the time, but at least right now they're just open about it. They don't care.
Space Force.
Right now they're emboldened in their douchiness.
Well, which I mean, like,
agree with, but
not to get into a debate about it, but I think liberals want to excel or meet the high standards that they've set for themselves and the people around them, whereas Republicans just don't give a fuck. It's like, okay, liberals pretend to care about you. Republicans just don't.
Oh, yeah.
And they're honest.
Yeah, they're all, yes.
So it's all about virtue signaling and, you know.
They'll care up to a point, which is why I'm still kind of on their side of, like, at least they're trying to kind of give a shit, and the Republicans don't. So I'm like, that's where I'm at, of like, well, at least you're trying, but they are so full of shit a lot of the time.
Both sides represent enormous hypocrisies to me. If I were, like, really, really involved in politics, I'd be really depressed right about now.
That's why I'm like this, of like, I'm somewhat, I'm not
but this
I'm
is this is one of my problems with
aware, and I'm like, I don't have the answer. I don't know what's going on. I want to try, but there's no hope because we're human and we suck. We're not right. Vulcan.
Well, even then, this is my problem, is that the Vulcans are not progressive. They have taken an enormous leap backward. They may advance technologically, but they're animals, and yet they criticize humans all the time. I remember...
Well, that's the whole point of, like, it's almost like, we're suffering, so you should suffer.
Well, I'm reminded of something Quark said on Deep Space Nine. He said, I forget who he was talking to. Was he talking to Julian or Sisko? He says, you criticize the Ferengi all the time. You call us barbaric. You call us capitalists. You call us we're money grubby. We treat our women badly. We've never had any wars on our planets. We've never tried to destroy ourselves. We've never done anything like that. And you call us that. He was like on his high ground. And he's probably right. I don't know. But
yeah, the Ferengi, they're openly shifty.
Yeah. I mean, and everybody knows.
I'm going to fuck you over at some point, and that's the way it is.
So and now get into, now I'm going to be liberal Dave here. I'm going to be liberal Dave.
All right.
Their attitude toward women, they treat women like property, and apparently nobody has a problem with that. Vulcan, when you look at what they're doing, it looks like a strict, rigid patriarchy. But for some reason, the highest ranking person there is a woman. So it's like a female controlled patriarchy. She's supervising a battle between two men for possession of a woman. And she even says it, for possession. Who will become... to bring property. They're calling women property and possessions. It's very strange.
I mean, you could say for the left, I mean, you want to get into sort of the polyamorous, okay? It's usually these polyamorous dudes are usually gross guys that can't get laid, and it's usually like, you know, they can't get a 10, so they'll get 3 threes and a 1. And it's like, it's sad, but when it comes down to it, the women are really in charge of that.
But they're in charge of the patriarchy, though. I mean, if you view it
They dictate who gets to do who, usually, unless you get rapey, and that's a whole other conversation. But
that's there are species of animal on this planet that are like that, that control the females control the sex.
They have all the power. It is a kind of a rapey thing.
I mean, like,
yeah.
I think there's a tribe of gorillas in Africa, the bonobos, and the females signal that they want sex by rubbing their parts against the male, you know, and it's like,
That sounds human to me.
And even then, when you think about it, Vulcans
stick their ass in the air.
That's the Vulcans and cats. Okay, I was talking about my cat Sushi, who went into heat for the first time. She stopped being Sushi and started being the sex crazed animal. We had to get her fixed right away. So I'm thinking that is probably the power of this biology over Vulcans. But this patriarchal society that they have doesn't seem particularly progressive, and I understand that because they're Vulcans, you can make a comment on that, but I don't think any comment was forthcoming in that particular episode.
Well, remember, is this not coming from the mind of Gene Roddenberry, a well-known sex fiend?
Well, I don't know. I think Sturgeon created all of a lot of that.
Okay.
So I don't know that Roddenberry, maybe he added a few things, but I can't imagine that he would, because it wouldn't be acceptable in a TV show, even if it was science fiction in the late 60s. But also, they point out that the Vulcan females also go through prom fire. T'Pring doesn't seem to be going through any kind of prom fire. She's a cool, chilling, kind of moody character that is manipulating this entire situation, which is very interesting.
Again, that's most women.
And even Trip in an episode of Enterprise that I watched recently, he's like, I don't understand. You guys are so advanced and everything, and yet you have to have arranged marriages and all this stuff. We gave all that stuff up hundreds of years ago, and he's right. This is not advancement. This is staying in the past. And I thought that it would be illogical, if anything. I mean, this seems crazy illogical to me, David. Does it to you?
Well, I just kind of thought of this right now. You could say that Vulcans, the way they do things, it is a deeply religious sort of situation, I would say.
What is religion? Religion is complete illogic too. It's surrendering your faith and your belief.
There is when it comes to religion, most religions, it's very OCD. It's like, we have to do this, we have to do this, and it has to be this way because God said, and this is the way that it is.
Yeah.
And we have to work within whatever our God says is it. And it's very set in stone. And if you deviate from that, they flip out. So they turn into Rain Man.
You would think that Vulcans, with all of their technical know-how, they were out in space 100 years before us in the Star Trek.
They didn't get into space until they embraced logic, though, I would think.
Yeah, but with their scientific advances, don't you think they could have come up with some kind of a remedy for the Pon Farr?
I think they thought they did. Logic. We will logic our way through this, and we'll be fine.
Well, I mean, you can use logic to control your emotions to a degree, but logic is not a means to an end unto itself. Logic is just a practice that everyone uses.
Perhaps that is the dichotomy of Spock and Vulcans in general.
I mean, if McCoy and the emergency holographic doctor and Bashir, if they can come up with miracle cures for shit, can't they come up with a cure for the Pon Farr?
You know, those are very sort of human workarounds where Vulcans are so up their own ass about, I don't know. I didn't write the damn show.
Okay. I finally got you to admit it, at least. I don't know. All right. You got me. I don't know.
Damn it.
Fuck you.
Well, okay.
It's a TV show.
We get into the fight. Obviously, Spock overpowers Kirk. And so McCoy decides to cheat. And good on him for doing this. He gives Kirk a little injection to simulate death. He gives him a sedative or a paralyzer. Makes Spock and everybody else think that Spock has killed Kirk. And so they transport Kirk back up. The Pon Farr, the madness or whatever, goes away, I guess. Spock gets like a splash of proverbial cold water. He has no desire for T'Pring, and I don't think he ever did, really. I mean, I feel like, you know, the performance of Nimoy is really fantastic in this because he doesn't want this, and he seems like he's a slave to all this. He doesn't particularly like this, and I think That's, you know, I mean, maybe you could throw in the half-human bit, but he doesn't really like, I don't think he really likes Vulcans. I think that he does enjoy serving in the Starfleet. We're going to find out later on that he disappointed his father by not studying science on Vulcan and instead joined Starfleet, which I guess pissed off Sarek. So I think that Nimoy does a really good job of indicating to us that he is some kind of a slave to his people, and he has to do this. And it's like his Vulcan will always have a hold on him because every 7 years he's going to go through this horse shit. You know, and all this does is interrupt his work. It's like a time waster for him. He doesn't like it. And we do see, you know, finally at the end, when Spock comes up and he's convinced he's killed Kirk, so he's like, you know, there's a great line. There's a great line at the end.
Live long, T'Pau, and prosper.
Live long and prosper, Spock.
I shall do neither. I have killed my captain and my friend.
And that's a fantastic line. That's a Theodore Sturgeon originally authored line. It was not changed. Goes up. He says, turn over command of the ship to Scotty. Kirk shows up and says, don't you think you better check with me? And then he sees him. He goes, Jim!
There can be no excuse for the crime of which I'm guilty. I intend to offer no defense. Furthermore, I shall order Mr. Scott to take immediate command of this vessel.
Don't you think you better check with me first?
Captain! Jim!
And he's got this big smile on his face, and then he's, you know, then yeah. He has to kind of like, and this is like what's sad about Spock, is that as much as he can't express rage, he can't express happiness either, because it's against who he is, even though he's fully capable of doing it.
Yeah, and I would say this is the Spock embracing his Spockness, but also embracing his humanity, and, you know, it took the whole series and in the movies for him to kind of fully embrace. It's kind of when Leonard Nimoy realized he was Spock and Spock was him, and then he kind of just like incorporated everything that was Nimoy into Spock and everything was Spock into Nimoy.
Well, yeah, I think like we've said this before, I think he's a lot more comfortable emotionally in the movies than he is on the TV show.
He just accepted his fate, and when it wasn't a bad thing.
It's like he doesn't get, he shouldn't care. He's special. To me, he's not a Vulcan. He's not a human. He's a combination of the both. Therefore, he should embrace both sides and stop trying to be a Vulcan like he's always trying to do on the show. And then, finally, he gets around to a point, I think it's after Star Trek III, maybe even a little bit of Star Trek II in there, where he's just like, I don't give a fuck. I'm going to be me, you know?
Yeah.
And that's wisdom.
I mean, you could have a whole other allegory. You could say, like, interracial people, like, what they have to deal with and what they go through, which I have no reference for that, but...
You're talking about, like, say, a half-black, half-white person or something.
Yeah,
right?
that's a whole thing.
Well, yeah,
that's
they're constantly thing. At war with that, and I've had a few friends, and I've had a few girlfriends who've had to deal with that. I was actually broken up with by a half-white, half-black chick who told me specifically... you know, explicitly, that she didn't want to continue seeing me because I'm white. She has to be more black, so she has to date black guys.
I mean, that there's a whole sort of social thing where it's like, even if you're half black, according to America, you're black.
I guess
you have to deal with all the stuff that goes along with that.
I think it depends on how you look. I think if you're more on the dark side, you're assumed to be black. Like even President Obama. Yeah. I always considered him the whitest guy in the world, basically.
He was black enough to piss a whole bunch of people off.
And white enough to piss a whole bunch of people off.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he played golf, okay? He was terrible at basketball and he enjoyed golf. Is he white enough for you?
Hey,
that was a Bill Maher joke.
Sam Jackson has a thing in his contract that he has to have a golf course near wherever he's shooting a movie. So there.
So he can yell at the ball.
this motherfucking ball in the motherfucking hole.
So this is the, you know, it's a great episode, but for me it brings up a lot of problems and inconsistencies with Vulcans. That's all.
I thought it was great. I mean, that was the first one I watched accidentally.
Accidentally.
And I was entertained. I don't think I'd ever actually watched it all the way through, or, you know, you always catch things in bits and pieces sometimes. And I watched it. I'm like, you know, this is really good. This is entertaining. I learned some stuff about Spock and the Pon Farr. I was entertained. It might probably be my favorite of the three, actually.
Hmm. Okay, so moving on to Blood Fever. Okay, Blood Fever is what? Season 3. It's season 3, yeah. Okay? This is a kind of an important episode for a couple of reasons, but this is season 3 of Voyager. Ensign Vorek, who is the only other Vulcan on the ship on Voyager, played by Alex Enberg, who's actually the son of Jerry Taylor, who co-created Voyager. In addition...
Really? See, when I saw him first, I'm like, is that Bronson Pinchot?
Well, his voice sounds similar to that. He was also in a couple of episodes of Next Generation. He was in part 2 of Time's Arrow, where he played a newspaper man who's interviewing Mark Twain. And he also played a Vulcan ensign on an episode in the 7th season called Lower Decks, which is about, I guess, all of the subordinate or junior officers on board the ship. Not a great episode, in my opinion. A lot of people like it.
For a half second, I thought, is he the guy that played the sort of teenage Spock? You talk about Ponfar in Star Trek 3. I'm like, well, the age could be correct. And I'm like, no, it's not him.
I guess not. But, you know, when you're the son of the creator of the show that you're in, you get
you get work, yeah.
So he plays, he's a recurring character on the show.
And I looked him up after. I'm like, oh, he's in a few.
Yeah. And he's B'Elanna's assistant in engineering, and for some reason he's going through some shit. We all know what it is because we're Star Trek fans.
This might be my third episode of Voyager. Had he been in an episode before this as that character, and then they had like a nice sort of back and forth and a banter, so at least they set it up?
I believe. I'm not really sure. I'm actually not really sure.
Because I just see this guy. I'm like, who the hell is this guy?
You are now listening to Ship to Ship, a Star Trek podcast. With David Lawler and David B. Anderson. Boldly podcasting, where no podcast has... I'm not reading this. I'm not. Where's my coat? I'm getting out of here. I hate it here.
Ship, ship.
Alien frequency sensors.
Ship, ship.
He's behaving strangely. They're not quite figuring out why. Starts kind of propositioning B'Elanna, I guess. And this is around the time where B'Elanna started getting interested in Tom Paris, who she would eventually marry and have a baby with.
Which they really dance around it in this one, I would say, with him and her, where he like wants to but doesn't.
Yeah. It's very much kind of this, I love you, I don't love you, I'm just attracted to you thing.
I understand his point of view.
I have the information. Vorek was featured in 2 episodes prior to this one.
All right, maybe they were setting it up. I don't know. I kind of understand Paris's point of view of, you know, if I want you, but I don't want you in some sort of state. I want you to fully want me for me and not be some sort of weird thing, because that can go away.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially since they don't have any particular time limit. They could be out there forever. They could be out there for 70 years, 80 years.
Yeah.
So it's best, I guess, to hedge your bets. But the thing is, you got to think about the fact that since these people are going to be out here, they're going to need more crew. So they, you know, if I were Janeway, I would have encouraged open season on sex.
I was thinking about this, watching both of these Voyager episodes. For them being out in the middle of like nowhere in space, they sure bump into a lot of humanoids and humans out there.
Yeah, of course. There are very few like ridiculously not human aliens.
Yeah, they're not getting like vomit monsters.
A Star Trek conceit. It's always been like that. You always have creatures with 2 arms, 2 legs. Sometimes they do. The only thing I've noticed is that their alien noses are so dramatically different.
Yeah, but it's like I kind of understand it in the other Star Trek, because they're out there seeking new life and new civilizations. You know, they're meeting different things. They're out in the middle of nowhere. Why are they keep bumping into people? I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what that is.
We notice already that this guy's behavior is a little weird. The doctor's doing tests on him. And and Tuvok already knows, and this is where it happens, this whole Plektow thing. It's called the blood fever, Plektow.
Perhaps we are not an obvious match. However, our differences would complement each other. You've often expressed frustration with your Klingon temper. My mental discipline would help you control it. Furthermore,
Please, I see that you've given this a lot of
logical thought, and I really am very flattered. But my answer is no. I'm sorry.
Lana, you may wish to reconsider. Your choices for a mate are currently limited to 73 male crew members on this ship, some of whom are already unavailable.
I'll worry about my choices myself, thank you.
I should also remind you that many humanoid species are unable to withstand Klingon mating practices.
Okay, that's enough.
Whereas my superior Vulcan strength would make me a very suitable partner.
The doctor doesn't have a clue. He just has, all he has is a couple of references in medical books, but there's never anything specific, which means that McCoy basically kind of kept a secret. He just talked a little bit about Spock, I guess, being sick or something. But Tuvok knows damn well what it is. He just doesn't want to tell him because it would be embarrassing, I guess. But the thing is, this is another thing. This is illogical. It is illogical for you not to tell someone about this.
Well, doesn't he kind of say, like, it can be dealt with if you go in an intense meditation?
He says that you can control it with med. I don't believe that either, because obviously it's shown later on in the next episode that we talk about that you really can't control it. Even someone as disciplined as Tuvok can't really control
it. Well, I think doesn't it come down to he needs to be able to go off into a secluded location and deal with it, and stuff keeps coming up, so he has to go deal with things, and then that messes up his concentration of what he's trying to do.
Yeah. There's a couple of distractions in that episode.
Hump death! Hump death!
Now here... what happens is Vorik attacks B'Elanna, and then he puts a mind meld on her or something. He fucks with her head.
Accidentally. Like, he's starting to bond because he doesn't know what he's doing. So he kind of, like, grabs her by the head. And
he's kind of instinctive, you know.
She does a Klingon move on her with, like, pow!
Yeah, she is not interested in him because B'Elanna apparently has a type. No. Oh, I wanted to talk...
I felt bad for him. I felt bad for him. I'm like, he got totally friend-zoned.
Yeah, well, that's the Klingon friend zone, which, you know, you can break.
Which you don't want to be in.
I guess you don't want to have your nose broken or something like that.
Yeah.
But Paris, I mean, the thing about Paris is he's very boyish. I guess he's kind of like the Riker and the Kirk of this particular Star Trek show, because he's kind of youthful. He has a boyish quality to him. And I guess he scores with the babes something.
He's not quite the bad boy that he played in that one episode where he was... Like, this, that was the one with Wesley. It was like, because he played somebody else, but he was in that episode where Wesley was put on trial for some sort of move.
Yeah, he played Nicholas Locarno in an episode called The First.
He played
Duty.
More of a douche in that one, I think.
Yeah, well, he was a lot more manipulative, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell them what happened. You're going to tell them what happened. You, alone, are going to decide what happens to me. To Cito, to Jean? You're gonna decide that?
I'm not gonna lie to them again, Nick. I can't live with it.
You can't lie to them. You can't live with this. You have to tell them what happened. Who the hell are you?
Nick!
You're gonna turn us in.
No, wait a minute.
No, you wait a minute! He got to you, didn't he? Picard told you some big story about duty and honor. Well, it must have been a pretty good speech to make you turn your back on your friends.
But I don't think it's that much of a stretch from that character to Tom Paris. Just, I think Tom Paris gets in a lot of trouble, actually. He winds up in prison. He was in prison. He was a black sheep of his family. His father's an admiral. He's kind of estranged, and he gets on board the ship to help them capture the Maquis, and then they wind up in the Delta Quadrant, and that's
their
show.
Now, look, he's been through a lot. He helped He-Man save the universe a few years earlier.
And,
you know?
Yeah, well, and he was demoted to ensign, and then he was re-promoted to lieutenant later on because he fucked up. Meanwhile, Harry, I want to mention Harry, almost exemplary Starfleet career in the Delta Quadrant, never gets promoted. In fact, he gets yelled at for having sex with an alien. Janeway kind of sees him as a son. I don't know what she sees Paris as. I think she sees Paris as a brother, like a dirty uncle or something like that.
And she sees Chakotay as a sexy man.
Kind of. They have to go, for some reason, they have to go spelunking into some caves or corridors for some kind of mineral. So they go down there with Neelix and with B'Elanna and Paris. And now, meanwhile, B'Elanna's starting to get really crazy. She's getting crazy.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that now, because I've seen so few episodes. She seemed very, right before the like half pawn far hitter, she seemed very peppy and fun and
kind
and
of
like,
well, I don't know. You know, the thing about B'Elanna kind of irritates me. She's always irritated me. She always irritates my wife and daughter in a way that Kira kind of irritates us too. It's not on the actress. I think she's told to behave this way. She's really incredibly high maintenance, and she's got such a chip on her shoulder that I don't find that terribly attractive. And she's not like very friendly with anybody. And maybe it's that kind of Klingon human hybrid or something. Kind of like,
yeah, I think that's what it is.
Like Worf's.
Worf took forever to mellow out, and he still never really did.
Well, Worf is all the way Klingon, but his girlfriend, God, what was her name? Kalar, the one he had the child with, Alexander. Now she was like that too. She was temperamental, and I guess you're either very cool and sedate if you're human, or you're really violent and nasty if you're Klingon. But if you try to combine those two, you're not going to get a very good soup going, you know?
You're upset.
Your finely honed Betazoid sense tell you that?
Well, that and the table.
I warned you about my Klingon half.
So you're going to get a sassy human with some weird bumps.
Oh, meanwhile, okay, the doctor tells Tuvok to talk to Vorik. He doesn't want to talk to him. He just doesn't want to do anything.
Well, yeah, I mean, say you're human and you go to a doctor and your doctor says, can you talk to your friend about his sexual weirdness?
Because like, he's okay, not talking to me, you know. And you know, Tuvok eventually relents. He goes in. He talks to Vorik. He's like, I know what you're going through. Try meditation, you know.
I must apologize for the intrusion, particularly at this time.
Then you know.
Yes. I regret that I must ask you some uncomfortable questions regarding Lieutenant Torres.
Yes, sir.
It is important for me to know specifically what happened between the two of you. Was there any physical contact?
Yes.
Please describe your actions.
It's hard to remember. I was acting irrationally. I believe I approached her. I touched her face. I meant to be gentle, but she tried to move away, and then I was holding her more tightly, both hands on her face like this. It felt very important not to let go. I'm not certain why.
I believe you were initiating a telepathic mating bond.
Or something like that, something along those lines. And
well, I mean, there was a thing called the NoFap movement.
NoFap.
Where guys just wouldn't even touch themselves or anything, and like they seem to sort of get some sort of new enlightenment from it or something. I don't know.
I think that's still going on. I think it's those.
They can be sexually repressed, and then
those incels. Remember the incels that they're always talking about, involuntary celibates.
Yeah, and then they get pissed off and they do violent stuff because they need to get laid. They need to get something.
Yeah, Vorik claims to do it. He claims to feel better. And then he goes nuts.
I'm fine.
Well, first, okay, they go spelunking into this weird. They find these weird creatures that exist in the caves, and they seem to camouflage themselves. It's a really creepy, nice effect. I like it.
Yeah, but they still look kind of human.
Oh, yeah. They look like rock creatures, but with, you know, like us. But
could they be the what they were what Shatner was trying to do in Star Trek V?
No, I don't know. The rock creatures they wanted to create for Star Trek V looked really good, but unfortunately, they didn't move very well. Only one of them was made, but, you know, if you had a whole army of those kind of creatures, that might be kind of...
Would that have saved the movie? Would that have made it... or would it have just been, like, the full embracing of the silliness of the movie?
It just would have been that, what you just said.
Yeah.
They say they're hiding in the caves because their species has been decimated by an unknown third party until we get to the end where we get the great reveal. Then they disappear back into the caverns, And Paris and B'Elanna come out. Neelix got hurt, so he's like completely ineffective in this entire episode.
He usually is.
So we go out there, and they can't beam up to the ship because Vorik has turned off the transporters, and he beams down, and he wants to get into a fight with Paris.
That was a little surprise. I'm like, you thought he was better, but no, he was fucking with the. He was like waiting until his opportunity to go down.
Ah!
You are my mate, not his.
What are you doing here?
Come to claim you, to fulfill our bond, and if necessary, to face my rival, Lieutenant Tuvok!
Ensign?
Sir, I declare Kuna Caliphae.
The ritual challenge. He intends to fight to win his mate.
If you want to fight, you've got one.
Hold on, Tom. There's not going to be any challenge. Are you responsible for the ship being out of contact?
It was necessary to disable the communications, transporters, and shuttles. No one will keep me from my mate.
I am not your mate!
We will soon decide that.
If anyone is going to smash your arrogant little face, then I will. I take your challenge myself.
She has the right to choose her own defender, even herself.
Just hold on. Neither of you are thinking straight right now.
They are following their instincts, and I suggest we allow them to do so.
You mean let them fight?
It is logical. Both must resolve their pon far before it kills them. We cannot wait to hear from Voyager.
They'll tear each other to pieces!
The risk of injury seems preferable to the certainty of dying from a chemical imbalance. Commander, I see no alternative but to follow Vulcan tradition.
But there's a great porno movie moment in this whole thing. After, well, B'Elanna's so pissed off because she doesn't want Vorik interrupting her trying to attack Paris, which is what she keeps trying to do throughout this whole episode.
Yeah.
So she fights Vorik instead. And she basically, I guess, kicks Vorik's ass because Vorik is weakened. But she's still, like, really horny as crazy. And everybody, including Tuvok, is like, okay, Tom, you gotta fuck her. So he's like, what? I have to fuck? You're telling me I gotta fuck her? Yeah, go. Just go. Go into another place and just have sex with her and get it out of her system. Which is, like, a very porno movie moment there.
I am concerned about the rapid progression of her symptoms. You must help her now, Mr. Paris. If she does not resolve the pon far, she will die.
Yeah, but then he's like, no, I can't do this.
I guess he does this thing where I have too much respect for you to take advantage of you, and I know you don't think I'm taking advantage of you.
In this situation, I am Tom Paris again. It's like if I'm going to have you, I'm going to have you in a healthy way. I'm not going.
But all that's going to do is just create a lot of sexual frustration with B'Elanna.
Yeah, well, she can deal with it.
I mean, it's an actual medical condition. He could go along with it just to be a friend if he wanted to, but he decides not to.
I couldn't. No, you know, it'd make it too weird.
We get to the end of the episode. They go back up, but then Chakotay sends an urgent hail to Captain Janeway to beam down, and he has found something that she needs to see.
Your call sounded urgent.
I think there's something you should see, Captain. We found this as we were clearing away the ruins. Undoubtedly, one of the invaders who destroyed this colony.
They find the remains of a Borg drone in the bushes of the planet. And this begins the cycle of the Borg on Voyager, which is, to me, one of the great... They really did the Borg. They did something with the Borg that I didn't think was possible. They actually created very well-rounded characters in the Borg that weren't necessarily bad guys, maybe bad from our perspective because... they're the opposite of individuality, and they just seek to make you part of them to make themselves great. And they seek out perfection in that way. And
they're making space great again.
Space Force.
Yeah, in a way. And this begins the whole Borg thing that will start up a couple of episodes later with the finale of the third season called Scorpion, which then leads into Scorpion Part 2 and the introduction of Seven of Nine. So what did you think of this episode?
It was okay. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Voyager in general, but watching it again, it has to do with, at least in these kind of episodes, it felt very played for laughs. And yet at the same time, like, it gets rapey, which makes it uncomfortable.
Rapey, yeah.
And so it's like everything just sort of works out after an attempted rape. Everybody's fine,
but,
I guess.
Yeah, but that's Amok Time was the same way. It's a rapey kind of thing going on.
That was the '60s when I guess it was okay.
I don't know. I'm a little more uncomfortable with some of the stuff, some of the revelatory material from Muck Time than I am here, because I grew up in this time. This I can understand more, and I think the writers do a better job of creating the world.
Do they ever have a moment with that ensign and B'Elanna again, where they sort of address?
Not really. B'Elanna still doesn't like him, and they're a little bit tense with each other on occasion.
Certainly after that.
I have a feeling that B'Elanna really doesn't like Vulcans all that much. I really, you know, I mean, I kind of get that impression. She doesn't like, she's very much kind of
remember, it's like they kind of have a moment, her and Paris have a moment in the lift at the end, and they kind of look at each other, and then like, he kind of like explains like, look, I wanted to do it, I don't want to do it right, and if you ever, you know, and then she kind of like, she's like not budging, and then at the very end she walks away with that smirk on her face, like, keep trying.
So, looks like you're feeling better. You back on duty?
Yes. Hmm. Yes, I'm fine. Thanks. The refit is going well. We should have new warp coils by the end of the week.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it. Computer, halt turbo lift. Look, this is ridiculous. We are going to be together on this ship for a long time.
You're right. We have to pretend that the whole mission didn't happen.
But something did happen, B'Elanna.
Look, Tom, I really appreciate what you did, what you were willing to do for me. But as far as I'm concerned, I was under the influence of some weird Vulcan chemical imbalance. And whatever I did, whatever I said, it wasn't me.
Yeah, I know. You're afraid that your big, scary Klingon side might have been showing. Well, I saw it up close. And you know, it wasn't so terrible. In fact, I wouldn't mind seeing it again someday.
Yeah, she says be careful what you wish for.
That's women for you right there.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. That's probably why I don't like her that much. Because she reminds me of almost every woman I've ever known. All right, so we move on to season 7, Body and Soul, which I mentioned earlier that Tuvok's Ponfar that he's going through. He must have gone through Ponfar right before they left on their mission and wound up in the Delta Quadrant, because 7 years to the day, he's experiencing Ponfar. And obviously, Voyager was not meant to be a long-term mission. It was meant to only just grab Chakotay's crew and arrest them and get them back to Starfleet. And they were not prepared for this, and they didn't have like a ship's counselor, which is interesting because a lot of people have personal problems on the show. But in this episode,
There is like an actual like A plot, and then the Ponfar is like the B plot.
All right, Bonnie and Soul premiered November 15th of 2000. Okay, Harry is on a mission with Seven of Nine and the Doctor. They're aboard the Delta Flyer 2.
Oh,
They're studying a comet, and then they come across some aliens who are what are they? Okay, they're
very human looking to me.
Yeah, they're very human looking, of course. Now, this is when we get into Voyager, where we come across the little bigotries that go on in the Delta Quadrant. There are whole races out there in the Delta Quadrant that are prejudiced against what they call photonic insurgents. Because there was a race of photonic people. Now, photonic basically means kind of like holographic in a way. Oh, I should mention that Robert Duncan McNeil, Tom Paris, directed this episode.
Yeah.
So there's some bigotry against photonic people. There's bigotry against lots of different types of people. There's even an episode where there's a whole race of aliens that are prejudiced against telepathic people. And they seek to arrest them and place them in concentration camps or something like that. Now, they hide the Doctor inside Seven of Nine. And this causes Seven of Nine to adopt a new personality, which is the Doctor. And actually, I really have to hand it to Jeri Ryan. I mean, like, even my wife was saying this. Yeah, she might be pretty. She might be a pretty face and really built. But she's quite a good actress, actually.
Yeah, she kind of...
When she's given the opportunity.
She has a Picardo-esque feel to her when he's in there.
Yeah, and there's a great scene too. I mean, it's like, you know, she's trying to demonstrate how harmless they are. She shows them their replicators, and she orders up a New York cheesecake, and she takes a bite, and it's like,
yeah,
she'd never really, well, the doctor really, the Doctor is somehow experiencing everything that that Seven of Nine is doing.
We are not smugglers or terrorists. We are explorers. Let us contact our ship. Our captain will explain everything.
If you're innocent, then you won't mind telling me more about this vessel.
For instance, this device.
What does it do?
That's a standard food replicator.
Can it be used to create bioweapons?
Not unless you count Mr. Neelix's Boolean souffle. Let me show you. Computer, one slice of New York cheesecake. This is an old Earth delicacy.
How do I know you're not trying to poison me?
Oh, please. Oh, I never imagined.
Is this the first time you've tried that?
Of course not. It's just that I usually avoid foods that are this rich. I do have a figure to maintain. Oh, I better get another for you. Computer, another slice of cheesecake.
What other foods can that device create?
And he goes absolutely orgasmic over this cheesecake, and he gets grabs some champagne.
Well, I think for her personally, that might be the first time in years she'd actually eaten something like that, because, you know, she has to stay pretty and be in an outfit.
Yeah, maybe. Probably. She gets drunk on champagne. She goes back. Harry has no idea what's going on. He just sees Seven as drunk. She has to sleep it off. Meanwhile, the captain of the ship, of the alien ship that has them captured, starts to fall for Seven of Nine for obvious reasons. When she embodies the doctor's personality, and the doctor kind of takes her over, makes her really attractive, apparently.
Yeah, she's a confident, fun person.
Yeah, and she's not. And she gets pissed off about this too. She likens it to rape, almost, that the doctor has taken over her body and is forcing her to do things like, you know, eat cheesecake and champagne and eat all kinds of foods.
Wasn't it the only way he could save himself, though, or something?
Yeah, because he had to hide.
I'm a doctor.
Shh. I would never abuse your body. I was trying to get information. Sometimes a glass of wine can loosen the tongue.
One glass. That doesn't excuse the other eight.
Was it that many?
Seven, you were aware of everything?
Painfully.
I'm afraid the role of spy wasn't written into my program. I was forced to improvise.
You improvised your way through an entire cheesecake, as well as three servings of Katerian chocolate puffs. Now I have to suffer the consequences.
I apologize if I overindulged. I'll be more careful next time.
There won't be a next time.
I'll be discovered. They'll decompile my program.
Shh.
I know this is difficult for you, but you're gonna have to put up with it until we can get out of here.
How do you propose we do that?
Maybe you can tap into their comm system, get a message to Voyager.
Deciphering alien computers isn't exactly my forte.
But it is one of mine. If you can get close enough while they're accessing their systems, I'll be able to observe their command protocols.
They would have decompiled him, which apparently is like, you know, deleting him or killing him in a sense.
He
has no backup file, not anymore. So they get drunk, they laugh. I mean, they're just laughing like crazy and just having a good time. Meanwhile, Tuvok is not feeling well. And this is very interesting because it's a B plot. This is when I remember Deep Space Nine doing this, where you would have the major plot and then you would have like a little B plot involving subordinate characters. I think even Next Generation might have done this too. I'm not really sure, where there was like a B plot. I remember there was a terrible episode from the seventh season called Force of Nature. That was Data. They spend 20 minutes at the beginning of the episode talking about Data and his cat, and Geordi thinking about getting a cat, because let's face it, it's Geordi. He's going to grow up to be a crazy cat lady, you know, so he wants to hang out with Spot a little bit to figure out whether or not he should get a cat. I think Geordi should have had 10 cats. But then before we even launch into any actual episode, it's like, pointless. I don't understand why they did that episode. I had no story whatsoever. Anyway, Tuvok is going through his own POMFAR. It's about time anyway.
Looks like some kind of virus.
It is not a virus.
You want to tell me what's going on?
In the doctor's database,
You'll find a medication under file Theta 12 Alpha. Please replicate it immediately.
You know I can't give out medicine without knowing what it's for.
If you must know, I am suffering from a neurochemical imbalance.
An imbalance?
It is native to my species.
This wouldn't be the kind of imbalance that comes around once every 7 years.
My Ponfar is in the early stages. The urges are still controllable.
You never fail to amaze me, Tuvok. A man of your advanced years still driven by the mating instinct?
Unlike in humans, the Vulcan libido increases with time.
Well, I guess there has to be some kind of reward for all that Vulcan discipline.
The doctor anticipated my needs and developed a treatment. Combined with meditation, it will enable me to control the symptoms.
Well, if that doesn't work, there's always a cold sonic shower.
And so Paris just comes up with this brilliant idea. Hey, we'll go to the holodeck. We'll program up Vulcan for you. We'll get an image of your wife.
Hump death, hump death, hump death.
And
they already tried that in the previous episode that we watched.
They tried something along the lines with Vorek.
Eh.
But it didn't work for him for some reason. I don't know. Maybe
he just didn't stick or something. Well, it works. It kind of works in this where it's like when he finally can get in there.
Hump death, hump death.
If the woman looks like his wife, he can manage it, sort of.
He tries, but they keep having problems with their hologram, with the holodeck too.
Yeah.
Eventually, it kind of works out. I guess what is he supposed to do? He's just supposed to. It's like, again, this is a great porno movie setup because you're encouraging somebody to have sex or something like that.
Hump death, your time is running out.
And maybe he needs a good fight. Maybe he needs a good ass kicking, or something like that.
Yeah, he could have just fought, put someone in there and have him so he doesn't have to feel weird and sexual about it. Find him somebody he can go in there and beat the shit out of and feel better or something, you know.
And also, I mean, if he needs to do something biochemically with his body to somehow render the effects of the blood fever, make him harmless if he could.
Yeah.
Tuvok doesn't want to do it at first because he says he's married. He says, no problem. We'll use your wife. You can go in there. Another good-looking, I want to say African-American Vulcan. Which,
yeah, and that was a thing of like, now that's kind of racist of like, okay, the one black Vulcan has to have the other only black Vulcan. Like, couldn't have been any other race. It has to be a black woman.
Well, I don't know, but I don't want to think about it, but maybe the writers were pressured to make it a same race marriage. Maybe they couldn't deal with a black Vulcan being married to a white Vulcan or something.
Just completely throws me off because, I mean, it's just because, you know, Spock, it's like Vulcans look kind of a specific way. They look very sort of Leonard Nimoy-esque. And they have yellow. They have a look like, and then you get later with like, say, like T'Pol. She looks like she would belong with that tribe.
I don't know. T'Pol, Jillian Blaylock, she has a very exotic look to her, but she
exotic look. Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's a very sort of angular kind of.
But
look.
She looks like she could be Middle Eastern. I would say
could be.
You know. Like that, and then we also have Tuvok who is black. So that just indicates to me the Vulcan is like any other planet, where you're probably going to have different people of different skin color based on what part of the planet they come from.
The Vulcan seemed like it was all sort of like one sort of hazy weather. Like it seemed like they would all kind of look the same sort of ethnicity, color.
I don't know, understand why they all have to have dark hair and the same styles too. That's another thing.
Well, that's probably a religious thing.
But it's also like Khan. Remember we talked about Khan, how his crew looked originally on the TV show. They were all they all had dark hair, but then in the movies they all had blonde hair.
They were all older too, and then somehow they got younger.
Yeah. Tuvok is fine after he finally, you know, does it, I guess, with the holographic image of his wife or whatever. Meanwhile, they have to try and figure out how to rescue the doctor and Harry and Seven of Nine. What happens is the doctor is attracted to this woman who was on the crew of this alien ship, which makes it a little bit. I mean, it's interesting here, all the connotations that you could derive just from this episode alone. There's a lot of weird character stuff going on here. I thought it was really, I really enjoyed this episode mainly because it was so nice to see Seven of Nine kind of like relax a little bit. I mean, it's like,
yeah, but she had to do it with another person in her body, though.
But something, well, not Seven of Nine specifically, Jeri Ryan. It was good to see her do that. Because most of the time she is just has to be this. We are Borg. You will be assimilated, and she can't really express herself. You know, so when she smiles,
I'm pretty sure Kate Mulgrew still probably didn't like her because she's like young and pretty.
Well, no, I don't think it was that. I think it was that they brought her in with the intention of improving the show's ratings because
it did. It worked.
And I was explaining this to Regan, who loves Kes. Regan loves Kes and says, you know, that, you know, she likes Seven of Nine too, but she really liked Kes.
And that's 10 pounds of crazy in a 5-pound bag right there.
Well, no, you're talking about the actress. But the character of Kes was kind of boring because she had a short lifespan and she was always pleasant. She was very much like members of the crew of the Enterprise on Next Generation. Everybody was nice. There was no conflict. She was always very sweet. Whereas Seven of Nine represented a lot of conflict and was very interesting. And also, let's face it, she's fucking crazy ass attractive. Mm-hmm. Nail that.
I mean, I was nuts for the girl. And what did it to me was these big titties she had. For a 13-year-old girl, man. She wouldn't have to worry about no titties for the rest of her life, boy. You know, she was set and she was looking good, son.
That's the truth, baby.
With that body and
many
everything.
Many men did.
And she and Jeri Ryan gets an opportunity to be charming and precocious and have a sense of humor. And she lets her hair down. She tries to be sexy. And it's really wonderful to watch. I just, you know.
I was amused that like it looked like they ate a ton of food and her stomach was still completely flat.
Well, I mean, it's going to take a little while to gain some weight. But she'll be back on her Borg supplements in no time. Don't worry about that. And she can always use the great tactic of just sticking her finger down her throat.
Maybe that's what she did. I don't know.
We don't know. She has a great bit here where she's yelling at the doctor. She says, "You became sexually aroused in my body." And the doctor, again,
like, does he get an erection on her, like, girl system towards a woman? Like, I don't even know how that physically works.
Well, you know, it takes two to tango. As it says, I mean, there has to be a little bit of Seven that was enjoying this, but she would never tell you. And the doctor and Seven have a wonderful relationship that started off initially with the doctor being infatuated with her. He gives her lessons on how to be a human, how to go out on dates and things like that. And then he just goes ahead and just takes over the driver's seat when he's in her body. And the both, just wonderful. And Robert Picardo is just such a fantastic actor. He brings so much to that character. He's very much the kind of, for me, on Voyager, Robert Picardo was the breakout actor of that show.
What happened was between me and Seven of Nine, not you.
I'm sorry you feel that way. The truth is, aside from a few awkward moments, I enjoyed our time together. There are many women who'd appreciate an attractive man like you. I'm just not one of them.
More of our vessels are on the way. You should leave while you can.
Thank you.
I guess you won't be introducing me to your brother.
I'm not sure you're the kind of person he's interested in.
You mean because I'm a hologram? I don't imagine this experience is going to change your feelings about photonics. But I wanted you to know, I'm grateful for the time we've spent together.
You're a talented doctor. We're the ones who should be grateful.
I'm glad I could help.
Because, again, it was a character very similar to a Data, as played by Brent Spiner. He's a character that is seeking humanity, and he wants to be human, and he considers himself a distinctive life form. Just a wonderful actor, I think.
Yeah, he's in every Joe Dante movie that we know of, I think.
That's because I think Joe Dante, every director has an actor that they can just say, can you play this part for me? Just do this part for me. Well, and he says
Joe
yes.
Dante has too. He put Dick Miller in everything too, I think.
He puts Dick Miller in, yeah. That comes more from a love of the B movies that Dick Miller was in when he worked for like Roger Corman and people like that. But Robert Ricardo, Wendy Shaw, you know, people like that would often show up in Joe Dante movies because you can say, you can just ask these people to be whatever you want them to be.
Like he'll be an explorer and he'll play a star killer with a wig on.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. So what do you think of this one? I think this one was better than Blood Fever. What do you think?
You know, I put them about on the same level. I was, you know, I'm not a huge fan of, I haven't fully gotten into Voyager. Maybe if I watch a few more, I'll enjoy it more. It's much kind of like Deep Space Nine. I'd probably enjoy it more if I wasn't coming in. It's sort of,
we're all over the map when we're doing these because each of our episodes is based on themes. So we just go.
I've been enjoying the old Star Trek more lately as I've been getting into it, watching them for this. I would say it's good. I was entertained. I wasn't pissed. I wasn't like, oh, this sucks. But I was like, this feels very, very 90s UPN to me.
And what's more, Seven learns a little lesson about herself. And at the end of the episode, she brings in some wine and some foie gras, which I've never had, just to eat with the doctor. And they have a good time. And
you don't want to be doing that too much, lady. You look good now, but you don't want to. Get all the wine and the cheese is going to kill your body right there. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Let's wrap this one up. Ship to ship. Next time we're going to be discussing another movie. It will be Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, because all of this was a lead in to our discussion about this movie, Star Trek III.
Yeah.
And until then, I guess what you want to say something?
I was just going to say, the Ponfar is in that movie, but it's, I would say, a smaller aspect of the overall movie, I think.
Yeah. The Star Trek III is more kind of fan service for the people who remember the show.
It took a while for me to like figure out, I think they did it. I think.
What are you talking about?
Ponfar in Star Trek III?
Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah. Well, when the kid is going
to. I mean, I it took a while. I didn't even know. Cause again, I didn't know. I'm like, oh, it's Spock. They're bringing him back or whatever. I'm like, only in the last few years, I was like, oh, I think they fucked.
Wait, who fucked?
Savick and Spock.
Oh, you think Savick did it with him?
Because if you look at in the movie, and we'll probably get to it, when he's going through his Ponfar, she knows what it is.
Well, she knows what it is. She's Vulcan.
Yeah, right. And he's like shaking and everything, and then she just says like Ponfar, and then they do kind of a hand thing, like they the do beginning the, of it.
Well, yeah, that hand thing is just actually no. That was just a kind of a way that Vulcan couples hold hands, because I remember Amanda and Sarek do that.
But
in
if he hadn't fucked, he would have died, right? Because he didn't kill anybody. He probably had.
It's possible, and also I think he gives her a look when he's finally restored and he's walking past everybody that helped him, and he stops at Savick for a second.
Look, yeah. If I'm not,
I was just thinking, hey, you're not Kirstie Alley.
That too. I think that maybe we'll do research on it. Of like, I think the original idea was that he does do the Ponfar with her. If I'm not mistaken.
Okay,
we'll get to that.
Until then, I'm David Lennon.
And I'm David Anderson.
We'll see you at the movies.
Get to the chopper. Good night. Something in the moonlight catches my eye. Shadow.
You have been listening to Ship to Ship, a Star Trek podcast, with your hosts, David Lawler and David B. Anderson. To find out more about us, subscribe to our YouTube channel or visit us at www.blissville.net or on Facebook at Misadventures in Blissville. Good night.